Coming up on Broadway Radios this week on Broadway, we talk about Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. Phantom of the Opera turns 25. We also chat about the Atlanta Junior Theater Festival and Pleasures and Palaces, a 1965 musical from Frank Lesser that never made it into New York. Please stay with us for more.
Here within this garish palace called the Music Hall.
There you are!
I'm very glad we are that
there you are.
It isn't who you are, but where
you are.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radios this week on Broadway for Sunday, January 27th, 2013. My name is James Bruno, and on the broadcast this morning we have Peter Felicia, Michael Portantier, and Richard Azunian. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books, the most recent being the Broadway MVP's 1960 to 2010, The Most Valuable Players in the Past 50 Seasons. His columns appear at MTI, Critterland, Massworks Broadway, and in many other places throughout the internet. Good morning, Peter.
Hi.
Hello. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at the Sondheim Review and Broadway Stars. He's also a photographer whose work can be seen at followspotphoto.com and many other places throughout the internet. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
With us, we have a special treat, Richard Azunian, who is the theater critic for the Toronto Star. He is also writes for Variety with regard to the Canadian theater scene, and we're going to have to get more deeply into this, but Richard also is an accomplished director who directed, his most recent directorial project was a transgendered version of Guys and Dolls, which I understand is touring coming up soon. Richard, tell us about that for a brief second.
I did it for a theater that's about an hour outside of Toronto called Talk is Free Theater that does a lot of amazing stuff. I approached a lot of people at the show on Stratford Festivals and said, gee, in your off season, would you be interested in doing something different? And we did Guys and Dolls with all the exactly as written, but all the female parts were played by men and all the male parts were played by women. And it actually worked amazingly well because people stopped thinking they were, quote, playing in Guys and Dolls, you know? They actually treated the book and the music and the lyrics quite seriously. It's a very funny show, but a very touching show. And we've now got a bunch of offers to tour it around Canada and possibly actually as far away as Australia next year.
Wow. That's tremendous. That's awesome.
And just one final thing for the Guinness Book of World Records. Kyle Blair, the young actor who played Sarah Brown for me, while he was rehearsing for me, was asked by the Shaw Festival to play Sky Masterson in their production this summer. Now, if there's a boy who must have total gender security, I think that's it.
Talk about.
Well, they always say when you do a show, you get to know everybody else's lines. So he's all set.
Exactly.
Well, that kicks us off. I neglected to mention that I am coming to you from the Weston Playhouse in Western Vermont right now. We are skiing with the family this weekend, and the Weston Playhouse has offered a little bit of shelter to do this broadcast. So I appreciate that. And have you guys ever been to Weston to see some shows?
I haven't either.
No.
They have quite an interesting history aside from the upcoming season that they have. It's mostly summer theater. In fact, it's all summer theater. It's pretty much closed up for the winter. But the but it used to be a full Equity House Regional Theater, and they a handful of folks got together and converted it to a nonprofit theater and did some really interesting things here. So they have coming up this season, they have Educating Rita, Next to Normal, 42nd Street, To Kill a Mockingbird, Loving Leo, This Blessed Plot from Mark Wolf. So it's certainly from the big musicals to progressive stuff like Next to Normal and small little plays
nice
as well. Yeah, it's they go from June through September 1st. So,
how far away from the city?
From which city?
Our city.
Well, I think the drive.
Touché.
The drive. You know, we New Yorkers are. So everything is centered around New York. But
so did you drive?
I drove. It was about a 5-hour drive.
Okay.
It was about a 5-hour drive. It's not a
probably
a,
closer to Toronto. No, it might be.
Yeah, it's quite. But it's westonplayhouse.org. I encourage everybody to check that out. So getting into our agenda for the day, on the Broadway front, Cat on a Hot Tin Roof has opened, and Michael and Peter have seen it. So, Peter, why don't you start us off with that?
Okay. Scarlett Johansson is playing Maggie the Cat, and I had a tough time understanding her during the first act, where, of course, she dominates the proceedings. When I came home that night, in fact, I put on a DVD I had of Jessica Lange and Tommy Lee Jones doing it. It was so nice to hear those lines because I really didn't hear them in the theater. The mile-a-minute delivery doesn't work for me at all. So I thought I was going to have a really miserable evening. But the funny thing is that, once Scarlett Johansson leaves the stage, she barely comes back. It really becomes everybody else's play, especially Brick and Big Daddy. And they did well by themselves. So as a result, I had a better time as time went on. There were some things that drove me crazy about the direction. And no, I did not see the famous Skipper scene that was cut out before they let critics come in. Rob Ashford didn't pay attention to the text sometimes, it seemed to me. I mean, there's that scene where Big Daddy mentions that Cooper and May said, you ain't sleeping in the bed with Maggie. You've been sleeping on the sofa.
Yes. So, what sofa?
Yeah. I mean, I wish they had put the sofa in the bedroom. I know that we're talking about scenery that's supposed to be on the abstract side and all that goes with that. But I think when a line is mentioned that specifically, I think you got to put in the piece on stage when that comes up. There was also a scene, too, where Deborah Monk couldn't get into the bedroom because the door was locked. And a few minutes later, Goopa waltzes in. I mean, he just opens the door and comes right in. I mean, I don't know how it got unlocked. It's not like you saw him take out a key or anything. So I thought little touches like that indicated to me that Mr. Ashford wasn't paying enough attention to what was going on. I understand that this is a limited engagement. I understand the tickets need to be sold as many as possible because it's not going to be there that long. But the sad truth is the Richard Rogers Theater stage is just too big for this play. And so the set has some empty space on each side, which is, of course, supposed to be hallways. Nobody can argue that there aren't hallways in the house. But still, it gets a little lost on that stage. I'm sorry to see it there. The economics, as I say, demand it. Okay, I concede that. But in terms of an aesthetic experience, it was a little woebegone. Still, I did have a decent enough time for the second two acts. As long as Scarlett Johansson wasn't there, I could understand what was going on and enjoy what was going on. It's still a good play. If we were still in an era where you could second act shows, this would really be a real treat, But they're very sticky now about let me see your ticket and all that. So I can't recommend that anybody do that because you're not going to get away with it anyway. But I think you might have the best experience if you were to see the second two act. If you're late for this one, don't worry about it. You're really going to have a better time.
All righty, Michael, what did you think?
I agree with every word Peter said.
Wow.
I think this is another example of a somewhat flawed but nonetheless great play triumphing over real ineptitude in the production. Starting with the set itself by Christopher Oram, it's got no walls, which is fine, but here you have these people on this huge stage trying to project their lines in this tremendous vacuum. And not only that, to add insult to injury and rub salt into the wound, Mr. Ashford has people frequently delivering their lines facing upstage.
That's true.
I've never seen anything so amateurish in my life. It's just unbelievable. And you know, it's funny. I had read before seeing the show. At least one person said that Scarlett Johansson sounded like Hattie McDaniel. And I laughed and I thought, oh, how ridiculous. How could she possibly sound like Hattie McDaniel? Well, she sounds like Hattie McDaniel. Because what she's doing is she's in her desperation to actually project her voice. I guess the area of her voice in which she feels she can project is the lower part of it. And she winds up literally saying things like, those no-neck monsters, what are you doing with those no-neck monsters? And that's how she sounds. And I don't think it's the way that Maggie is supposed to sound. And it tremendously hurts the character. She doesn't come across as seductive in the least, regardless of how beautiful she actually looks, and spending so much of her time in a slip and just really not wearing a whole lot, which I'm sure the audience appreciates that. But as far as the attempt to seduce Brick and to be sexual towards him, that just it's really not even there as far as I could see. I thought Benjamin Walker was quite good despite having no direction whatsoever. He wasn't the coiled spring that Brick usually is. He wasn't as morose in the first part. But on the other hand, it can be difficult to play Brick that way and still communicate to the audience and be interesting. I remember when in the production with Ashley Judd and Jason Patrick, played Brick as very, very, very drunk and very morose and very dark. And it became boring quickly. I looked at the movie recently and
yes, Paul, so Newman, did I.
Paul Newman is, yes, as you said, yeah. Paul Newman is so brilliant in it. But of course, it's somewhat easier to play the role that way on film because the camera is so close and you have nuances that are very difficult to do on stage, especially in a theater like the Richard Rodgers. When all is said and done, I thought that Ben Walker did quite a good job, especially in the scene with Big Daddy. Kieran Hines, is that how it's pronounced?
I think so.
Yeah. Absolutely excellent, I thought, despite everything. I was very, very impressed with him. His southern accent sounded spot on to me. Deborah Monk, I thought, was somewhat at sea as Big Mama. She didn't really seem to have a grasp of the character. And also, it seemed to me that her southern accent suddenly disappeared at some point when she started to when the character started to become very worked up. So that was a disappointment. Ridiculous staging, aside from people constantly talking upstage, as I said. Ashford also has people constantly moving around. I mean, Brick is on crutches. He's on a crutch. And he had him like, you know, it was like a musical. He almost never stopped moving from the bed to the liquor cabinet and across the room and then back again. And yes, you need some of that to keep visual interest, but I just thought it was way, way overdone.
I just have to stick in here. I wonder what directors do sometimes, because we had a production of Cat at the Shaw Festival in Canada a couple of years ago, and they decided to stage the whole thing on a really steep rake. Mm. Yeah. So picture how much fun Rick had all night trying to maneuver his crutches on a rake. It's like, take them all out and shoot them, why don't we, you know?
No, that sounds like a big mistake. Another staging weirdness was that at some point everyone kept ending up on the bed, including Big Daddy and Brick at one point. Big Mama was on it at one point. I guess Ashford felt because it's in the middle of the stage, he has to have everyone be on the bed at some point, and I just thought that was ridiculous. As Peter mentioned, the fact that there's no sofa didn't make any sense. And I don't know. I mean, I see what you're saying. It's there's a somewhat abstract quality to the set in terms of there being no walls, as we said. But the actual furniture pieces, are pretty much realistic. So I don't think that he deserves an out for that reason. And, you know, having a sofa there would have actually made things a little more interesting as a reminder that these people are not sleeping together. Because the only other Rick keeps going off stage right, but I think that's supposed to be the bathroom.
Yeah.
So we're not supposed to believe that the sofa is in there. And what else? There was some good character work among the supporting people. I very much liked Michael Park as Gooper. But it just, you know, it just – this is a show that really needs a director. And I mean, someone said the phrase they use is that Ashford has been crucified for this. And I don't necessarily think that's inappropriate. I think it's just it's really kind of amazing how poorly directed it is. And apparently he has a reputation for getting along well with big stars like Daniel Radcliffe and Sean Hayes and Scarlett Johansson and the people he's directed in plays in London. But I don't know. I mean, it's only part of it, isn't it? I'm sorry this is not a better directed production, and I'm sorry that Scarlett Johansson – I think she might have been a good Maggie in a more intimate setting, possibly with another director. And I certainly think she might have been a good Maggie on film, but who knows? Maybe we'll see that someday.
All right. Richard, do you have any plans to get down to New York to see this production?
No, if I had been thinking of doing it, I think I might have canceled them. Everything I've been reading makes me feel this is one to be avoided at all costs, unfortunately. And it's a play that we've seen so many great productions of over the years. You know, you wonder why we keep having to see bad ones as well.
I'm going to have to say I very much like the last one better, the quote-unquote Black Cat.
Yeah.
James Earl Jones. And, you know, because obviously, even though on some levels it doesn't really work realistically, I think they got the play more. I really do think they did. And I saw it early on in the run. And Terrence Howard, when I saw it, was quite excellent. I heard some people say that they didn't feel he could sustain and that as the run went on, he was not as good. But when I saw it, he was very, very, very good.
What do the three of you think about the discussion in and around the chat rooms and various other Angus McDo's that we have had too many Cat on a Hot Tin Roofs? Is it too soon for us to bring this back?
No, because it has nothing to do with how many times we see it. It has to do with how many times the public goes to see it. It doesn't hang around that long that everybody who wants to see it can see it. I remember – this brings to mind Ethan Wooden's excellent observation back in 1962 when My Fair Lady announced it was closing in August. And suddenly there was this surge at the box office and they had to stay open an extra month because people just don't get around to seeing things much as they'd like. It's one of the reasons why when a show announces it's closing the last week of the run, they tend to do better business than they've been doing. People say, oh, I've got to get to that. But it's very easy to let a theatrical production slip through your fingers, especially with prices being what they are. So we can't apply the fact that we see it too much. These things are done for the public, and so it's perfectly fine.
Michael, Richard?
I think go ahead, Mike.
No, please, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say the question that the people who approach a production of a show like Cat should really ask themselves is, what have the last production or two been like? How long ago were they? Were they terrific or not? And what are we going to do that will be different or better? Or dare we go, you know, riding into the same valley of death? I often think what happens is producer and a star think, oh, yeah, I want to do Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. Sure, Scarlett Johansson, let's cast her. And they kind of forget that there's some heavy competition out there by people who have done it very well in the last decade to 15 years. That's the only thing I think we should ask before we do revivals.
I see Peter's point, and I mostly agree. But on the other hand, there's an argument to be made that if a very poor production of a classic is going to be done just as a star vehicle or for whatever reason, it quote unquote hurts the brand. But I hate to phrase it that way because that's
I know.
But to phrase it another way, it lessens the possibility that it will be done again in a good production. So I don't know.
To be fair, when they start out, nobody knows if it's going to be good or bad, you know. So I mean, that's to me a bit of Monday morning quarterbacking. Anyway, go on. I'm sorry.
No, you're right. But what I mean is, it would seem like the impetus behind this was not to do the best possible production of Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, but just to do it as a vehicle for a star. I don't know if anyone remembers, but at one point, this was supposed to be even more of a star vehicle. Jeremy Renner had been mentioned as playing Brick, and I think also Chris Pine. So that didn't happen, and they got Ben Walker, who is an excellent actor, and as I said, did quite a good job overall. But when you get into discussing people's motivations, it can be kind of tricky. But if we look at it, it does seem like that maybe the point was to do it as a big name star vehicle rather than to just do the play as best as it can be presented.
You know, Peter's point about if we can bring people in and if the audiences still demand it is, I feel, a tremendously valid one. And later on in the discussion, I was going to talk about last night's Phantom 25th anniversary. We try to think about, Phantom here for 25 years. Who could have imagined that 25 years ago? But as we sit here 25 years in, with grosses that are still doing very well and a very popular show overall, could we imagine another 25 years from now that Phantom would have a 50th anniversary? And what does that do to is that holding back Broadway in some aspect, locking up theaters for years on end for long-running shows? Or what do you guys think about that?
Well, it is in some way. I mean, it's amazing when you think about it. For years and years and years, the long-run champs on Broadway were shows like My Fair Lady, which ran for about 7 years, shows like that. And then it got upped a little bit, more than a little bit with Chorus Line, which was, right. Was that 15 or?
Yeah, 15. Yeah.
You know, and then we could go on and on, but it's really about the change in Broadway to becoming primarily a tourist function, a tourist attraction. And so who knows? I mean, obviously the old rules no longer apply. Maybe there is no new limit. People have suggested that maybe Phantom will never close.
All righty. So Peter had skipped out on us last week because he's been traveling all throughout the United States, and one of his stops was in Atlanta last week at the Junior Theater Festival. So Peter, why don't you give us a brief synopsis on what you saw?
If there are any teachers out there listening, you must be aware of this Junior Theater Festival, where schools come from all over the country, and I'm even including Wyoming. They bring their kids, and they do the musicals that they've done this fall, or the musicals they're about to do this spring, and they do 15-minute excerpts from them in function rooms. It's a competition, there's no question about it, and some kids get named Best Actor, et cetera, et cetera. But so many people get awards that it almost ceases to be a competition, I'm happy to say. But there's really tremendous work being done by kids and their teachers, and it's really so nice to see so many kids, and I mean so many kids, meaning 4,200 kids that were there this year. There were 3,000 last year, really, 40% increase. Now, how many businesses can boast that in a single year? So it's really quite wonderful to see all these kids who care about theater so much, who can't stop singing and dancing even when they're walking down the halls, and getting up there and then finding out from pros such as Brian Batt was there to give his feedback. Dean McFlicker, who's an NBC vice president, was there too. To assess how they do. And needless to say, some schools are better than others. Some schools are phenomenal beyond belief. But to see these kids who care so much about musical theater being surrounded by kids who care about musical theater, I'm reminded of a very good book I just read called Better Nate, than ever by a young author named Tim Federle about this boy who's 13 years old and living outside of Pittsburgh who desperately wants to get to New York, who says, I want to talk theater with people who won't, whenever I mention theater, won't slam my face into the toilet. Well, here are those kids. You know, I mean, to have all these kindred spirits there and validating the fact that you love to do, you love to perform, you're interested in what's happening on Broadway. So that was terrific. And what was really nice was Alan Menken came down, and considering that 20 of the 82 schools were doing Little Mermaid, because that was just recently released for amateur production. It was so great to see kids going crazy. At dinner, you know, Alan Menken said, you know, when I started out, I really didn't have interest in musical theater. I wanted to be a rock star. I said to him, you're going to feel like a rock star tomorrow night. And he certainly did, with 4,200 kids screaming at this 62-year-old man, 64, whatever he is. I mean, it's great, you know, to see kids caring about somebody like this, who has given them so many songs. When he was singing, they couldn't help singing along. They had to join in. In fact, they knew the lyrics sometimes better than he did. What was also interesting is Tom Schumacher was there and interviewed him and said, why don't you play that song we dropped from whatever? And he knew the words to every song that was dropped perfectly. Well, the songs that made the movies, occasionally he'd say to the audience, you have to help me with this. And they certainly did, because they knew them inside out. So a wonderful experience. And teachers, do go to the MTI website if you want to find out about this and be there next year. It's held every January. It's always held in Atlanta because iTheatrics, a company from Atlanta, was the one that founded it, along with Nick Manos, who runs Theater of the Stars there. So well worth attending. You'll feel very good. You'll learn a lot because there are master classes. Ken Billington was there teaching about lighting. Jeff Calhoun was there talking about his career and how it happened. Many, many, many workshops after the performances are done. You also get to see the new shows that are going to be available next year. Boy, there was a group. Oh, there was a group doing Hairspray. It said it was a middle school. I think what they must have meant was they were in the middle of grad school. That's what they must mean, because I'm telling you, these people were amazing. It didn't seem like a middle school at all. So really, go and be overwhelmed. But I beg teachers who have drama clubs to think about going down there.
All right. Well, after Atlanta, was it after or before that you ended up in Dallas?
Right. Irving, Texas, to be specific, at Lyric Stage, a marvelous theater that's about 20 years old. And one of the things that Steve Jones does that is going to be applauded by so many people who are listening, because this isn't what's done anymore. He says, when we do a show, we do exactly what the authors intended. We don't do anything remotely approaching a revisal. We don't say, you know, it would be a good song here. You know, I mean, that's not what we do. So as a result, I saw what was exactly seen in Detroit in 1965 when the musical Pleasures and Palaces closed in Detroit. It was that script. It was that score. Not a word was omitted. This is what the final audience saw on Saturday night. And what's interesting is, in 1965, when that show was in trouble, it announced it was coming to Boston, where I was living at the time, and I was really looking forward to seeing it. But finally they said, you know, there's no sense in going on. This is the show that Bob Fosse famously said, when we had a meeting deep into the Detroit run, I realized when the book writer was talking and when Frank Lesser, the composer lyricist, was talking and when I was talking, we were dealing with three completely different shows. We saw it in completely different fashion. And, you know, it's true. You can really feel that by watching this show. The show is about Catherine the Great. It's also about John Paul Jones. And it's also about Potemkin. So it certainly fits the bill of musicals should have big characters and big events. Because what's happening is Potemkin has really been running the show for Catherine, and now she's losing faith in him. And she hears that this John Paul Jones has done very well in starting the American Navy and has won battles. And as a result, maybe he's the man who's going to be able to defeat the Turks. So all that's very good. Now, the irony, by the way, is this is based on a play called Once There Was a Russian, which ran on Broadway for one night. Who would think that a one-night flop would run longer than the musical version? Because, as I say, the musical version didn't even come in. So that's really amazing. How often does that happen? All right. Why is this a problem? Well, for one thing, the show seems to revolve around Potemkin, and he's really not a nice guy. Historians will tell you that, too. There is not one moment in the show where he does anything nice. He's always venal. He's always trying to put things over on people, even to the point at the end of the show when he's supposed to be hanged, he has somebody take his place. And, you know, this poor guy we actually see him dead on the floor while Potemkin, you know, smiles at us. And by the way, it was originally a British actor named Alfred Marx, whom you may not know, but you may remember Jack Cassidy, who took over for him in Detroit. So think of that type of bravura type of performer. The play, by the way, Once Upon a Russian, starred Walter Matthau as Potemkin. So again, I think you can get a sense of who this character is from those two actors. But always doing the wrong thing, and was supposed to be charmed by him. The problem with John Paul Jones is he's such a straight arrow. He wants to do the right thing. He's incorruptible. And one of the things that Potemkin does is have him get some drunk and puts him in bed with this young Tootsie, who was originally played by Phyllis Newman, by the way. Then Catherine would come in and see him with her and be jealous and throw him out of the country, or at least in prison. Thank God she throws him in prison, because I'm telling you that when she throws him in prison, he sings a song called with the prisoners called Ought to Be Home Again, which is first-rate Frank Lesser. It's a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful song. The rest of the score, no, I'm afraid not. Easily his worst score, with very few songs worthwhile. What's really ironic is John Paul Jones, after being in bed with this Tootsie, he's scandalized when he awakes. I mean, he's been forced to drink liquor, you know, have another toast, drink to my country, all that stuff. So when he wakes up, he's really apoplectically upset about it, and he's this staunch Presbyterian. The word Presbyterian is mentioned a lot in this show, and eventually what he does is he shows the girl the error of her ways, and she becomes a staunch Presbyterian too, until the end of the show, when suddenly she decides she's bored by it, and at that point she sings about that pleasures in palaces is really what she loves. She talks about diamonds, she talks about caviar, all that kind of stuff, about loving creature comforts. And then 2 seconds later, she's back to being a Presbyterian again. So you really get the impression the only reason she repented from being repenting is so she could sing this vampy song about liking the good life. So it's a very confused musical. However, this Lyric Stage Company did it so proud. I mean, it was amazing. They told me it was going to be a concert. Okay, what does that mean? Music stands, books, right? No! No, in 2.5 weeks, they learned the whole show, and I'm telling you, I was there opening night, the first performance, and nobody missed a cue, nobody missed a word, everybody was letter perfect. It was astonishing to me to see this company down there do better by the show than the show did itself. In fact, I'm not going to say who, but somebody who was with the original production was there and said, you know, these people are really doing a better job of it than the original people did. And that's quite a compliment, because, I mean, really, John McMartin, by the way, was the original John Paul Jones. so these are good people, Phyllis Newman, you know, Jack Cassidy. So to get a compliment like that from somebody who has seen it almost 50 years ago is quite a compliment, and they deserve it. I couldn't believe the professionalism on that stage, where everybody knew what he was doing every step of the way, and it was really, really sensational. And there was some choreography, too, and it was really terrific as well. So I'm very glad I went, as I always am. It's another one I can check off my list that I have seen. I can't imagine that we're ever going to see it again. I know the Lesser Estate would love to see it be put into availability for amateur and stock groups. I doubt it. One of the things, too, is the fact that it was a very right show for its time, because it dealt with the fact that Americans were good and Russians were not, you know, and of course, during the Cold War, I mean, this show premiered only a few months after Khrushchev was taken from power. And so, I mean, that was a big deal then, and we're less concerned with that now. So I think even that part of it is kind of dull under the circumstances. But wow, one comes away with great respect for Steve Jones and Lyric Stage. So congratulations to both of them.
I think that really is, the, as far as I know, the last of Lesser. I remember seeing Senor Discretion himself, which was kind of resurrected. That was one of his last projects, and that was done down in D.C. And then I actually saw another reading of it somewhere, and I had heard of Pleasures and Palaces and you know, kind of heard it mentioned as the Holy Grail and the last thing. So that I hope to, yeah, I, as you say, who knows if it'll ever be done again, but I would love to see it.
I understand.
Yeah. any chance that they perhaps recorded it for archival purposes?
Mm. I mentioned about that. But I will say that that after an hour of the show, you could hear all these clicks around the theater of tape recorders going off, and you know, so and cassettes being turned around, and you know, and so.
I'm sorry, Peter. Did you say if Joe Sullivan was there?
I didn't say that, but yes, indeed, she was.
Oh, not, yeah, I'm not surprised.
And took a great interest in this project. So yeah, she was encouraging them all the way. So it's a nice company. It really is. Next year they're doing Blue Roses, which is the musical version of The Glass Menagerie by Mimi Turk, who I, in fact, it was the first Amalia I ever saw in She Loves Me, playing opposite James Rado of Hair fame, with Jane Alexander, then unknown, as one of the shoppers who came in to the perfumery. Mimi Turk has written, along with Nancy Ford, an adaptation of Glass Menagerie, and they're premiering it there next season. So so they do adventurous work as well as standard work. I will admit that when Steve Jones came on and said, listen, we've just announced our season and we're going to be doing The Sound of Music, everyone, ooh, you know, I mean, so, you know, people want to see the War Horses, you know, but he knows how to schedule a season, something for everybody.
All righty. Well, hopefully this has quenched the thirst of many folks who have traveled far and wide to see a less often done production of that. Richard,
yes, sir.
You have upcoming in your neck of the woods a premiere of Aladdin. Is this the new route to Broadway is through Toronto for Disney? What do you think?
Well, you know, Toronto was for a period, especially in the Drabinsky years, you know, the one of the major go-to stops on the way to New York. That kind of faded. Chicago took over for a while. Disney has deliberately gone after Toronto as their first choice here. I asked Tom why, and he said a couple of reasons. One is that the physical plants are terrific. We have a lot of really good big theaters. Also, the Mervish organization, which we'll be working with, has a subscription base of close to 40,000 people. So you know that at minimum you're going to get about 2 months of sold out shows. And then if it does well, you can do even better than that. And also, he has seen from past years with the long runs of Beauty and the Beast and Lion King and even like touring companies of Aida doing very well, Toronto loves the Disney shows. So he thought he would actually let this one try out there first. And so we're getting it this fall before it goes to Broadway.
Well, it's interesting to see that that would be a development path. I mean, we've seen Disney do different things that were unexpected, bringing Newsies through Paper Mill
right.
last year, and moving things around. They're becoming quite unpredictable in the ways in which they're going about it, which shakes up the thing a lot and makes it a lot of fun to talk about and see what.
I think the thing that other people are going to find interesting too is that Aladdin isn't going to be necessarily the movie brought onto the stage, period. Tom was saying that, you know, Howard Ashman, who was very ill when he started working on it and passed away before it could be completed and Tim Rice had to take over, had a much different show in mind. And he, in fact, had outlined and written a different version. And when they sat down to talk about doing it again, Menken dragged out the script and said, you want to see what Howard really wanted to do? And, for example, the genie was never supposed to be Robin Williams. He saw the genie as kind of a Cab Calloway Fats Waller figure. He saw not as many animals, in fact, virtually no animals. He saw a lot more human sidekicks. He saw it as a Bob Hope Bing Crosby road movie. And they're trying to recapture that and do that. Of course, there will have to be new songs and things, but it's going to be a different version. As I said, don't expect you're going to see, you know, necessarily just a 30-foot-high blue genie doing voice tricks and four or five of the songs, you know. It's going to be a different show. A lot of the things that, you know, people love, because that's the brand, that's what you're paying to see. But it sounds like this one is a little bit more of an experiment than some of the others.
Well, also coming through Toronto is Andrew Lloyd Webber's Project of the Wizard of Oz. You want to tell us about that?
Well, I guess I have to. it was the first big opening of the year, and in fact, it's the only Toronto-based big opening we've got so far this year. I mean, everything else we're getting is on road tours and stuff and stopovers, and it has an all-Canadian cast, and people are happy about that. And we went through one of those reality TV shows to cast Dorothy, just like they do in England. We did it before with Sound of Music a couple of years ago. And a lot of very good Canadians got cast in the parts, and it just kind of lies there on the stage. As I gather, it did in London. I didn't see it there.
I did, and that's exactly accurate. You know, it did lie there on the stage. And by the way, I don't know what's going on in Toronto, but yeah. I will say that it looked like it cost $3.50 in London, which is really surprising to me. I really expected to have my eyes knocked out by The Wizard of Oz. It did not happen in London.
No, they upped the price to about $4.75, Peter. It's still looks pretty cheap.
I love when they improve things. You know.
I mean, Kent, you know, I'm sorry. Kent, would he just stop with this stuff? I mean, you know, he can write his own things. But does he really have to do this to classics? You know, he of all people, I just really wish he would stop.
Oh, I know. It's like you get all these awful new songs. And then also, of course, if you're doing it on stage, the first thing you think is, okay, what are the Munchkins going to be? And it's the same chorus playing everything. But the Munchkins kind of wear these frock coats and giant stovepipe hats, like, you know, they were Shakers or something. But they're all in Witchwood blue. And as I said in my notice, they all dance as though they're in the advanced stages of osteoporosis. They bend over a lot, hunched over to make themselves look smaller. And then when they're the witches' sidekicks, they all look like they're from a gay Russian leather bar, you know, in red and black. And then when you get to Oz.
Sounds great.
When you get to Oz, it's like somebody's really cheap high school ripoff production of Wicked. You know, yes. It looks like you're seeing One More Day in the Emerald City in a really chintzy version. What's interesting, of course, is it seems Andrew Lloyd Webber has forgotten about Wicked, among other things. And on opening night, there was a little girl about maybe 8 walking down the aisle ahead of me behind her mother. And she just turned to her and said, "I liked Wicked better."
Wow.
And I didn't blame her. I agreed at that point. So they're hoping to take this. They're looking at a 6-month run in Toronto, and then Troika has intended there to be a North American tour. I think they're going to see what happens in Toronto, because the reviews were all unanimously bad. I mean, one or two people threw them a few crumbs here and there, but you know, they were not good notices. Toronto papers still give stars. Most of them give 4 stars. People here gave like 2 to 2.5. You know, they weren't crucifixion notices, but they weren't money notices. So I will be, tell you, surprised if this goes on tour in North America. But they're still saying it is.
Well, if Troika does it, don't tell me it'll be a $4.75 production. It'll be down to $1.50 if Troika takes it out. Because they're notorious for
That's it. But for example, guys, they've got a lot of flying in the show, but it's the kind of flying you do in high school. It's the straight up, straight down. Remember that?
Yeah.
1954, you know? And it's – no. I kind of shake and shiver when I think about it. It was not a very good production at all, and a sad way to begin the year here.
Troika is sort of the Walmart of traveling theater. But
James had an interesting point. You know, it's interesting. What do you guys think? One might have thought that Toronto would long since have become a kind of a major tryout town for Broadway, especially after Ragtime. But that didn't really happen as so much. Paper Mill. I'm surprised it took that long for Paper Mill to become that. You know, I imagine that Newsies will really increase that. I mean, who knows?
No, Picknell actually had tryouts before, but not that many. But certainly in the 80s, Windy City was there, a musical version of The Front Page, right, that really had great aspirations. In fact, after the theater reopened, after the famous fire in, I think, 1980, I can't remember if 80 was the fire or 80 was the reopening. Robert Elizabeth, the London musical that ran over 2 years, was there, and every intention was to take it to Broadway, except nobody liked it enough to make that happen. And back in 93, Paper Moon was there at Paper Mill, Paper Moon at Paper Mill. And in fact, the Plastics were up at the Marquee Theater. That was coming in, I mean, except it didn't. So so there have been attempts, not a lot.
That's all I meant. I mean, I'm
Sure that's fair, Michael.
It just seems like, because it's so close to the city and it's such a big the stage is Broadway size.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it
just seems like, you know, and then of course there was Follies too, although that's a little different because that was intended. I mean, that wasn't intended from the beginning as necessarily a Broadway transfer. But it's just interesting to me.
The thing with Paper Mill is that Paper Mill is a self-producing organization, and so it's. I don't know if it's within their charter to mount a commercial production to come into Broadway as much as mount productions to sustain their audiences and do what they're doing there.
Well, but that also has changed.
That has changed with the leadership at Paper Mill in the last couple of years. Richard, the theater that's coming in where Aladdin's going to be, is that a four-wall rental, or is it a self-producing theater that's going to be co-producing the Aladdin with Disney, or...?
The Mervishes, I believe, are getting a co-producing credit on it. It's their theater. They own it.
Yeah.
And it's coming in as part of their subscription season. It will obviously be Disney theatricals, but presents. But on occasions like this, the Mervishes often buy into a show, you know, especially if it is Broadway bound and stuff. We haven't seen the Marquee yet, so I don't know what it'll read. But I think that's probably the intent. Because it's going to be the big thing on their season next year.
But I mean, it wasn't driven, or maybe it was, but I'm assuming it wasn't driven by the Mervishes. Didn't sit there and have the idea that, oh, we should make Aladdin,
as
Cameron McIntosh and things like that. But, you know, we do see in reflecting back upon Paper Mill Playhouse that the leadership has to drive this from both a producing standpoint and an artistic standpoint. And that brings us to our next topic of Des Makinoff and his relationship with the Shaw and La Jolla and Broadway and the Dodgers.
Stratford.
And how Des drives projects. And it seems as though that Shaw, he's going to have another production of Tommy. And why don't we talk about that for a minute, Richard?
Well, Mr. Makinoff, came up to be artistic director at the Stratford Festival. And at first, it didn't look like he was trying to send projects elsewhere, although a lot of them had legs implicit in them. Like, gee, wouldn't it have been great if the Caesar and Cleopatra with Christopher Plummer had gone, gone further and things like that. But it got pretty blatant a couple of years ago when he scheduled a Jesus Christ Superstar. And as soon as it opened and Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice approved it, the next thing we know, a show dropped out of the La Jolla schedule. It was going there. The cast were told it was going to Broadway after La Jolla, and it didn't quite end happily ever after, as we all know. Now, in the interim, Makinoff is no longer the artistic director. Anthony Cimolino was the general director before, is now the AD. But Des is coming back to do Tommy again. From what I understand, it is almost a picture postcard revival of the last production. Let's do exactly what I did before. And there is talk about it going to La Jolla and then on to Broadway, but Stratford won't be involved this time. Stratford has told me their involvement stops on closing night of the show at the Stratford Festival. And if the Dodgers want to take it to La Jolla, or La Jolla wants to take it to La Jolla and then to Broadway, fine. But they're not going to go along for the ride anymore.
That's going to be interesting. I think to myself, I really enjoyed, painting the St. James Theater yellow, and I really enjoyed how loud that production was, and the video screens from Batwin and Robin But, you know, why do that again? Let's hope that they come up with something new to talk about with and straighten that storyline out. They reversed it from the original Who's recording of Tommy, and the storyline became very convoluted. But we'll see what they do there.
Also, because Dez kind of had a bit of a stumble with Yoshimi. You know, his punk rock show in La Jolla got pretty tepid reviews, and I don't think it's going anywhere after that. So, and he's actually kind of going back home to La Jolla. He's also doing a new theater version of Sideways there this summer, which That's supposedly right. will go onward after that. You know, who knows? You know, yes, you can go home again. Des McAnuff and Tom Wolfe prove that.
Well, maybe Des McAnuff can become the artistic director of the Paper Mill Playhouse. He can stay closer to home and stay on the East Coast and develop stuff in a little triangle there.
That might be worth
it. I'm glad you mentioned that, James, about the ending of Tommy. I really, overall, I thought it was quite a wonderful production, but it always struck me as so incredibly strange that basically the ending was rewritten to say the opposite of what the original version said. And I don't know if that was mostly because of changes in Pete Townsend's worldview. I think that's how it was presented at the time. But I always thought that was a huge mistake, and I hope they go back to the original.
It was a confusing story for those of us who knew the Who's recording before the Broadway recording it.
Yeah.
We're like, what happened there? Father and the – okay, it's backwards. Yeah. So it's fun to see what great artistic people take on as their next projects. And Julie Taymor is taking on Midsummer Night's Dream at Theater for the New Audience, which I thought was very interesting to go from Lion King and Spider-Man into that. What do you guys think about Julie's twists and turns?
Sounds like a great choice of project for her, I think.
Yeah? You think she'll design scenery and costumes and things along with that, or is
You know, I just think that she, you know, took the wrong path. And I mean, what's wrong with Spider-Man, and God knows
there's many things.
Is the material and the adaptation. It wasn't necessarily her vision of it. So as far as I can remember, anytime she's done something, and not been involved in the actual writing of the text, she's done really, really wonderful work. Although I did also love her movie Across the Universe, and that arguably was she was involved in the construction of it, as far as the way the songs fit together and stuff. But anyway, I don't think there's much doubt that she's from a visual standpoint that she's an extraordinary artist. So and I don't imagine she's going to be rewriting Shakespeare.
I would say that's my hope and my fear, because I think if she actually does A Midsummer Night's Dream and brings her own incredible visual imagination to that play, it can be amazing.
Yes.
If she decides she's going to script doctor Midsummer Night's Dream, then we're in trouble.
Well, I certainly hope not.
Well, I, you know, hear that she's bringing in some people from art to take a look at it. What do you think?
All things considered, though, it would seem to be something that would fit her imagination. And I love when people who have had titanic Broadway successes don't feel that they have to only work on the Broadway stage, that they can go to smaller places and exercise their theatrical muscles in a smaller arena. So good for her for doing that.
Absolutely.
Yes. So moving on in our discussions, are we all sitting down here? Because
yes, sure.
It could be that the next Hollywood blockbuster is going to be the musical version of Jekyll and Hyde. As Jekyll and Hyde has been sold to a movie company to be made into a feature film, you know, I wonder if you know they are banking on the wild runaway success of Les Misérables, which passed 300 million.
Exactly the same thing.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know.
One wonders if they're paying attention to the reviews of the touring show that's coming to New York. I mean, I was unfortunately out of town when it opened in Toronto, but it got pretty soundly crucified by the press, and that's pretty much been happening everywhere. In fact, I'm actually surprised they're still bringing it into New York.
They're bringing it in, but they're bringing it into a different theater, I believe a smaller theater. Is that not correct? And I believe – I mean, I'm not sure if it was always originally planned, but now the Broadway engagement is being billed as limited.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
By popular demand, it's limited.
Getting a movie sale is far different from getting a movie. No Strings, She Loves Me, The Day Before Spring, all of those were sold to the movies. Your own thing, for that matter.
Carnival.
Carnival, yeah. And where are they? So
they've put Jersey Boys in Turnaround.
Oh, right. Yes, that's right.
That surprised me.
Yeah, so if that happens, you know, what makes you think Jekyll and Hyde's going to actually make it to the screen?
Well, things that get put in turnaround, they can get put in turnaround for any number of reasons. The executive who was sponsoring or promoting that movie at the studio might have left the studio, and you know, things get put in turnaround for the most ridiculous ridiculous turnaround means that it's still owned by the studio, but it doesn't have a date for being scheduled yet. I'm glad that you brought up the Jekyll and Hyde tour and what's going to happen in New York. Lisa Kennedy, who writes for the Denver Post, wrote about Constantine that he gets to act a lot in Jekyll and Hyde. And I think, you know, looking at the reviews that are coming through this tour, we wonder if it's actually going to make it into New York or if somebody's going to stop it.
I don't know. Well, you know, he now does confrontation with a hologram of himself. And as one of the critics in Toronto wrote, Cuccioli in your ponytail, come back, all is forgiven.
It's almost going back to what they had before. When the show opened in Houston, at least the second time, the show that wound up on Broadway with Bob Cuccioli in Houston did not have him swinging the ponytail back and forth. It did have a movie that he was dealing with, not a hologram, but a movie. So it seems they're going back to that. So I know one of the reasons that they wanted the marquee when it became available is they felt that the frontage on Broadway would help them. That especially now that there's that cute little pedestrian area where you can sit down. When you're looking at the marquee, maybe you'll say, hey, you know, there it is. I'll go see it. So I know that was part of the reason for moving to the marquee.
The other thing, now this is interesting. I haven't studied the grosses on the road, but it had a very short run in Toronto, and I thought it was going to be a surefire sellout with those names because Deborah Cox is from Toronto. They were papering like crazy to fill a 5-day run, which is interesting. It did, and that was before the bad reviews were out.
You know? What I'm interested in, of course, this show is very famous for having Jekkies, fans that came a number of times. One woman saw the show 527 times. So as a result, I wonder if those people are going to have this nice, wonderful reunion all these years later, or everybody has to go through stages like that. We'll see what it is, you know, as time goes on, if there's nostalgia or if, then was then, now is now.
Well, right. I would think that there would be enough audience for it to have isn't it only announced for like 3 months or something like that?
I think 16 weeks.
Yeah, so you would think that there's enough audience for that amount of a run on Broadway, you know, after a tour. I mean, it's not as if they're creating the show especially to run on Broadway. So I guess we'll see.
Yeah. Other things in the news that we sort of expected this, but I just wanted to mention it in passing, is that Jordan Roth seems to have bought out Rocco Landisman from his remaining stake in Joe Jamson. I think Rocco maintains a small percentage still, but we expected that after Rocco left the NEA that he was going to go off and do his own thing, and as we, I think, speculated on the podcast before, buy a baseball team, but we'll see what happens there.
He would love to have the
Cardinals.
Cardinals, yeah. Because he's from St. Louis. But I remember that he really made a very serious bid for the Cincinnati Reds.
Yeah.
So maybe that'll happen.
Yeah. So it looks like Jordan is locking himself, cementing himself further into being the future of Broadway, which is great for Broadway. Richard We want to talk briefly about the story about Cirque du Soleil and the cutbacks there. Why don't you tell us, give us a little backstory on that?
Well, what happened is, as you know, Cirque seemed to be absolutely indestructible. They started as a bunch of street performers in 1984. And as I noted, by the end of last year, Guy Laliberté, who is the owner of it, is one of the richest men in North America. And I think his net worth is something like $2.3 billion, from being an unemployed street performer to $2.3 billion in that time. But what happened to them is, starting with the end, literally 2012 was their nightmare year. Four of their giant permanent shows, not their touring ones, but permanent shows in Macau and in Tokyo and in LA and Vegas, all closed because of lack of audience. A permanent Cirque show costs between $25 and $100 million to mount.
Wow.
And they count on them running a long time. Like Mystère has been running 14, 15, 16 years in Vegas. O has been going 13 years. You know, they keep going forever. So four of these big shows folded, which is a lot of bucks, and things just weren't selling as well as they hoped. So they first let a lot of people go in their PR department, and then they let 400 people go from their offices in Montreal, where they still do all the shows. Now, that still leaves them with, 4,600 people on salary. So it's not like they're crippled, and they're being confident, saying that they are going to keep going. The word they're using is right-sizing. But an interesting fact I pointed out is in 28 years of their existence, in the first 14 years, they only mounted about 13 shows. In the remaining 14 years, they mounted like three times that. Mm-hmm. So they've started to do too many shows too quickly, and the quality control that used to keep them special has slipped. I am hoping they go back to that, because they are, at their best, they are wonderful, but if they are not at their best, it can be kind of garbagey, and I think that's what started to happen.
I have to say, even though this is a non sequitur, you're mentioning too many shows. Reminds me of the Steve Jones in Irving, Texas at Lyric Stages, next doing Too Many Girls, the Rodgers and Hart show. But I also want to mention something I should have mentioned before about Pleasures and Palaces, a 40-piece orchestra.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So he does that, too, when he does shows.
Wow.
So nice to see a harp coming out of a pit and being used, too. So that's definitely worth mentioning, and I'm sorry I didn't mention it before. So thank you for reminding me, Richard, by saying too many shows.
There we go. And too many mornings. We'll keep going.
All right. Also in the news is tomorrow there's going to be a ceremony up at the Gershwin, and it has nothing to do with Wicked. Or does it? The 2012 inductees of the Theater Hall of Fame is happening tomorrow with inductees Andre Bishop, Trevor Nunn, Betty Buckley, Martin, help me with his last name, Pac.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Pac Ladinas.
Thank you so much. I'm terrible at that. Christopher Durang, Paula Vogel, Michael Kahn, and Sam Waterston are going to be inducted at the Gershwin Hall in the Hall of Fame tomorrow. And they remind us that it's by invitation only, so don't just show up unless you have been invited. So it's quite a list.
That's a very, very worthy group, obviously. And I was so happy to see Mr. Pac Ladinas included.
That's great. Next, and probably our final topic of the day, is that we have a bunch of recordings that came out. Michael wants to tell us about, let's start off with Chaplin.
Oh, yeah. I mean, first of all, let me say, as an older bird, I'm just delighted that they're still putting show albums on CD. Do you think they always will, or will even those go the way of the dodo? What do you guys think?
It does seem that the CD's days are very much numbered. So, yes, I was very glad to see Chaplin as something I can hold in my hand.
Yeah, in the meantime, it's so nice to have them with the booklets that are so well done. And yes, you know, if you download something, you can often print out some kind of a booklet online, but it's just it's not the same.
Well,
thing.
I wanted to say that the production and manufacture of CDs, I think will be around for a long time, because people don't realize the actual cost to manufacture a CD and the physical media itself is negligible. Yet, if we sell the CDs at the theater, we can easily get $20 or more for the CD, and we don't have to share the profit with anybody. But if we sell it online at Amazon or with Apple, the iTunes store, things like that, you end up, you know, selling it for $10, and you give away about half of it in that. So I think that for a while, I think we will still see CDs, because the actual the profit margin in making CDs is much higher than selling them digitally, and you can have something tangible to sell at the theater, versus you can't really sell a digital download at the theater if somebody wants to pop it in their car on the way home or give it as a gift or something like that.
Oh, that's a really interesting theory.
You know, the manufacture of a CD, you know, when you're doing it, even in small lots of, you know, 10,000 at a time, you're talking about, you know, about a dollar a CD or less.
Right.
You know, and so I think that shows will spend, you know, a couple $1,000s, you know, $10,000, $15,000 to manufacture hard CDs, because they can easily make that back. And they like to send these things out in press kits and things like that.
Well, wouldn't it be funny if show albums remain the only things?
Yeah. Yeah.
For that reason.
I guess it could be effectively argued that they'd sell them at rock concerts too. So So what'd you think of Chaplin?
Oh, well, you know, I mean, we've discussed it. I think it was a very honorable score. I had problems with the lyrics, as I know Peter did. But it's got its moments, especially the two songs that I really, really liked so much. One that comes almost right at the beginning, Look at All the People, where Chaplin's mother is on the street with him when he's a young boy, and just pointing out how different people react and how you can get a little bit about their stories just by observing them, and how that, you know, how that informed his art as a great filmmaker and actor. And then the song that comes at the very end, This Man, where the entire company is basically summing up their feelings about Chaplin. So if only for those two songs, I'm really glad to have it on CD.
I will put in a vote for the Tramp Shuffle, the music of which went through my head for at least 10 days nonstop.
Oh.
I was tremendously impressed with the music on this CD. Again, yes, I'll never like the lyrics, but I think the music on this CD is really worthwhile, and I enjoy the melodies quite a bit, and much more than I did when it was in the theater. And I was sorry I didn't get back to see it after I knew the score inside out, because that's always a fun thing to happen. But nevertheless, I do recommend the music of this show.
That's great. Also, I got The Mystery of Chaplin, by the way, is Masterworks Broadway. From DRG, we have The Mystery of Edwin Drood, which I'm loving it, because, as I've said, I never had the original cast album. I'd never seen the show before. I went into this production cold, and it's an excellent production. I just love the score. I think it's got some absolutely terrific songs by someone who was not really a Broadway writer by profession, but Perfect Strangers is an incredible song. Moonfall is just so beautiful, and then the songs that are written more specifically in the English music hall style are tremendously fun and entertaining. So I'm glad to have that, this recording with such a great cast,
discs.
And two discs, and yes, and every possible option included for the denouement. you can listen to them all, or you can, if you're into that, you can program the ones you want, the outcome you want to hear. It's really fantastic. So that's great. I also got the first two recordings in what's apparently going to be a series of live cabaret recordings from 54 Below, Patti LuPone and Norbert Leo Butz. Terrifically happy to hear about those. I know Peter has mixed feelings about live recordings of actual shows, you know, musicals. Mm-hmm. But with cabaret, obviously, it's you know, I think it's something very different, and mm-hmm. you really can capture something that you don't get in a studio recording. So this is one of the happiest occurrences I've heard recently. And they're producing their own, you know, they're basically kind of self-produced, live at 54 Below, this whole series.
Does Norbert do Broadway material?
He does. Let's see. I'll just read some songs.
Because I know he has quite a pop career. So
he does Georgia on My Mind. He does Great Big Stuff. Uh-huh. from yes. And let's see. It's kind of a mix. Mostly not Broadway, I would say.
Uh-huh.
But there are a few things here. Let's see. The only other thing I wanted to mention is the re-release of the soundtrack recording of Bye Bye Birdie. because it's just, you know, even though it's so different from the show, as we've discussed many times, I think it's a kind of an interesting example of a film that works very well on its own terms, despite some rather odd decisions.
Well, you know, frankly, for all the strife that the Bye Bye Birdie movie takes, because, of course, of its silly plot with a chemical speeding up of a turtle, the fact remains that the song Kids in the movie is actually a better musical theater song than it is in the Broadway show.
Oh,
because
yeah.
In the Broadway show, Paul Lynde just rants and raves about kids, and that's all there is to it. What happens in the soundtrack in the movie is that the action actually moves forward in the way that musical theater songs are supposed to do. Because at the beginning of the song, Albert is saying, all right, I'm ready to give up my mother. I am ready to go with Rosie. And by the end of the song, he's decided to stay loyal to his mother, which prompts Rosie to go out and have her adventure with the Shriners, which is also on this recording. It had been on a previous one. Don't misunderstand me. This isn't new. There have been three Bye Bye Birdie CDs, and the second one included the Shriner Ballet, and it's here again. What you do get here, if you like the song One Last Kiss, this is the recording to have, because there are three recordings of One Last Kiss, of varying a studio one by Jesse Pearson, who died much too young, and who played Conrad Birdie. But you know, I will admit, I was a teenager when this movie came out, and I loved it, and I had seen the stage show too, so it was, no question about it, formulated for the beach blanket movie type crowd, as a teen movie. But I was a teen and I loved it. So I have great affection for the Bye Bye Birdie movie, and certainly Anne Margaret, who has two cuts on here of the singles that she released at that time, of the title song and How Lovely to Be a Woman.
And going back to Kids, you know, it's so much fun to see Maureen Stapleton in a brief musical moment.
Sure, sure.
I think her only other musical was Queen of the Stardust Ballroom.
Sure.
If you count that.
Right.
All righty. So I guess that wraps it up for today. Let me ask you guys, anything new and exciting coming up this week that we should look forward to, Peter?
What am I seeing? I'm seeing Barry Manilow.
Oh, yeah. Oh, we didn't talk about Barry, who lost his voice, and we pushed him. He pushed his opening back. I think that Michael Riedel was accused of stealing his voice. And so, you're going to go see Barry. That's great. What else is happening?
Well, Fiorello's coming up this week.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah, Fiorello. That'll be fun.
Good. Good. Richard, what's happening up north?
The land of people who lose their voice, and it's not quite musical theater, but the most awaited thing this winter from the Canadian Opera Company is they're doing Tristan and Isolde, all 5 hours of it, a new production directed by Peter Sellars. And so we're hoping that everybody's voices hold up all the way through in time, and it'll work out. But it's kind of exciting. A new Peter Sellars show, 5 hours long, Tristan, got to be there.
Sure.
And speaking of opera, very soon we're about to get at the Metropolitan Opera a new production of Verdi's Rigoletto, directed by Michael Mayer,
yes,
and reset in, wait for it, Las Vegas. So that should
that's what's going to go into one of those Cirque theaters, you know, after they finish here. Yeah,
Galetto becomes a Cirque performer. I see it now.
Well, that's great. We're all looking forward to reports on all that stuff plus more.
Yes.
I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe button. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded for you and you won't miss anything. Please also go to iTunes and leave us comments and feedback because that's much appreciated, and it will help other people find Broadway Radio as well so that we can share it with as wide audience as possible. You could also listen to us on the Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone, your Android device, your BlackBerry. That way you can listen to us streaming and on the fly. And we all are also played on Broadway World Radio. Broadway World plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia and Richard Azunian, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
I think I finally found